Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is You Can't Make This Up. You Can't Make This Up is the podcast where we uncover the true stories behind your favorite Netflix documentaries and films. On today's episode, we take a closer look at the Netflix documentary series Homicide, New York.
You can't shoot 5 people in New York. They're gonna hunt your ass down. They're gonna find you.
Today, we're talking to executive producer Adam Kasson. In New York City, homicides are investigated by 2 separate squads, Manhattan North and Manhattan South. From killings deeply personal to seemingly random, these police tackle some of the most difficult and high-profile murders possible. But what did it take to solve the crimes, and what did it do to those who solved them? In the Netflix documentary series Homicide New York, legendary executive producer Dick Wolfe brings viewers inside some of the real-life cases that shocked and puzzled the city. From the point of view of those who investigated the crimes and prosecuted the offenders, these are the stories of some of Manhattan's most notorious murders.
And that's what's important to me. Work for the common good of everyone to make the world a better and safer place.
And I'm joined now by executive producer Adam Kasson. Adam, welcome to You Can't Make This Up.
Thank you.
So the name on this project everyone will recognize is Dick Wolfe, the legendary creator of Law & Order and its many, many spinoffs. There's no announcer, but there is this card that opens each episode of Homicide New York, and it has, shall we say, a certain cadence when you read it. On the island of Manhattan, there are 2 detective squads dedicated to homicides, Manhattan North and Manhattan South. They investigate the most brutal and difficult murders, and then it ends with, these are their stories. Now, talk to me. Was there a discussion about whether or not to add that little dun-dun song at the end of this title card? That's all I could think about. I had to ask.
Well, I think we were over our music licensing, so no. So that couldn't work. Obviously, this is inspired Dick Wolfe and all the amazing, you know, work that he's done with the Law & Order series and New York City, you know, where it all started. And so the series in general reflects that, right? And so we had the beginning, and to be honest, the person who suggested it was Lindsay Webster, who was, you know, our executive at Netflix. She's like, oh, we should have this as an open. We're like, oh, is it too on the nose? Is it winking too much to it? And so, but we all talked to her like, oh, this is great. It's perfect. It's enough where it nods to the Law & Order and to Dick Wolfe's brand and his Law & Order series, but, you know, gave with a little bit of our own spin on it.
Yeah. So in the original Law & Order pitch meeting, Dick Wolfe famously said that the show Bible would be the front page of the New York Post. So he's someone who's always paid attention to the world of real life police work in New York City. So I'm curious, what does he bring to a nonfiction series about New York cops? Like, what does that sensibility bring?
Well, so much. I mean, just as far as first to even get the detectives come talk to us, there's trust right away because they all know Dick Wolfe. They all grew up, many of them, with his stories. They know and how they've focused on the NYPD throughout the years. And so everybody, just by knowing that Dick Wolfe was involved, it means a lot to them and getting them on board to participate in the beginning. And then just every, you know, the sophistication in his storytelling, how he's able to tell a procedural, how much he cares about trying to get to the characters, the stories, the victims, the procedural element of it. And that rings out, I think, if you see throughout the series.
I'm very curious about the visual style of this series because it's obviously unscripted. It's obviously not Law and Order. It almost has this like Hopper's Nighthawks feel to it with the settings that you use and so forth. And also the opening titles, you know, with the graphics and so forth, has this like sort of graphic novel noir feel to it. Can you talk a little bit about how you wanted this series to look and what the aesthetic of it, you know, that what those conversations were like?
Philippe Friesen-Bickler was our DP, who is fantastic. And we had a lot of conversations about the visual look and how are we going to film it. And, you know, you're shooting a documentary, right? So you don't have all the bells and whistles that you do when you're shooting a narrative series. So it was everything went down from how we were filming it with the camera package we have to the lenses, to the look, to making sure that New York felt like a character throughout, to making sure that each of these characters that we were filming in their interview settings had something to do with their character as well. And so we had a lot of discussions about that with Philippe, with our partners at Alfred Street, Jane Lipsitz and Dan Cutforth and Dick and Tom, and also that you can move quickly. So you can bring a detective down to walk around with him in the street without having so much. And Philippe is such a beautiful, you know, he shoots such beautiful imagery and he's a fantastic DP. And so we were lucky to have him on this project.
So another question I have, and this is something that comes up, at least for me, sort of thinking about, you know, the ethics of true crime filmmaking. And this is, I think, a balance you struck really well, because we do get, and I think, some necessary flashes of the brutality of the crimes here, which I think we need to get as these detectives talk about their work and as family members talk about their losses and what happened to their loved ones. What is the editorial conversation like when you talk about crime scene photos, like what to show, what to hold back, how much time you give those kinds of visuals? I'm sure that was a conversation, right?
Yeah, it always is. I mean, for me, and then for projects that I work on, and this one is important, you know, we have a lot of conversations, the editors, the other producers, and we don't want to show stuff that feels gratuitous just for the sake of it. And so as you notice in this series, well, we do show some crime scene moments and some moments of brutality. It's not gratuitous. Even the recreations that we film, it's helping to illustrate what happened to make sure you can see enough of the seriousness of the crime and what actually happened. And from an investigative standpoint, but not to make it like as if we are lingering on a horrific image just for the sake of shock value. So that's important to us. So just even as far as like how bright we make the color of blood, frankly.
Yeah,
we try to mute the colors. If you'll see, some of them are in black and white. So we try to distill the images so you can see enough of it without feeling like we are celebrating the brutality of it, if you will.
So there are hundreds of high profile murders that you could have focused on. What was the process of selecting the cases for this series?
We started with the detectives. The idea was that you were following a group of detectives and they were the way into these stories of the cases that affected them the most. So we asked them, and we wanted to have detectives who are connected to each other, either working with each other in some capacity, knew each other. And so we focused on Manhattan North and Manhattan South homicide units. And so they all worked with each other. They knew each other. They worked. They switched back and forth from some worked in Manhattan South, and then they came to Manhattan North or vice versa. But they were the ones who guided us first to tell us about the stories that and the cases that impacted them for different reasons. And we started with that. And we wanted to have ones that meant something to them. And then from there, then we went with folks that knew the victims, whether it be family or friends that could speak and make sure there was a voice to speak on them as well.
It was interesting to me that these weren't necessarily the most sensational nor the most famous cases. Were you surprised that these weren't? I mean, they were headline grabbers, to be sure, but they certainly weren't cases that I think we've heard about again and again and again and again as the decades have passed. I mean, were there cases that the cops talked about that, you know, were more familiar, that they really were hoping to talk about, or that cases you left on the cutting room floor? I'm just curious, because these did seem to have a lot of emotional resonance for the cops. And I was surprised by this selection.
Well, yeah, I mean, one thing we touched upon a little bit in East Side Serial Killer in that episode, which is the last one, where that case didn't get a lot of press at all,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they talk about how upset and disappointed they were. You know, you had all these African-American female victims and the press was not writing about it at the time, which was very frustrating to them. And so it was a case that, as you saw, had incredible emotional impact on the prosecutors, the detectives that were involved. They still think about it to this day. Yeah, you find that when you talk to the detective, just because a case got a lot of press doesn't mean that it necessarily resonated or didn't for them either way. And so the emotional impact that it had on the detective and their experience with it, you know, doesn't always equal the kind of press that New York wrote about.
Yeah. So obviously casting the right people is critical to any documentary series. And I can imagine this one was tricky for a variety of reasons. I mean, you had overlap between cops and characters. Then you also had to find cops who could really talk in a really like compelling way about their stories. Can you talk about how that process worked of finding detectives and getting them, finding out if they were willing to do it and getting them on camera and so forth?
We had a great research team that we worked with. And so we would kind of look both ways. You know, we would look at detectives that had said interesting things in the paper or had worked a lot of cases. We wanted to stay in Manhattan. We knew that. And so we're focusing on New York. We did that. And then we also would look at cases that seemed interesting that were during a period of time and what detectives worked on that. Because in New York, they have a lot of homicides, right, throughout the years and a lot of different detectives. And you can work in New York City as a police officer and never meet another police officer in New York City. That's how big it is. So we wanted to make sure they knew each other. So it was a constant flow of looking at cases that connected with the detectives that we were dealing with.
So we hear that the coverage area is divided in half at 59th Street between Manhattan North and Manhattan South. And we hear a couple of times that there are some cultural differences between those two regions of policing. How would you define those differences? Did you find that to be the case as you were talking to these cops?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little more tongue in cheek, you know, the way they would talk about it. And some of them, like Irma Rivera, Detective Irma Rivera, she was in Manhattan South and Manhattan North. She had worked in both. So she could give like a little bit more comparison. So, you know, they would talk about, you had different communities in below 59th and then above 59th. And so because of it, they would talk about how difficult or easy it was because of that, you know. And then the other thought was, I don't know how much we ended up keeping in the show. Scott Wagner talked about how the Manhattan South dressed nicer. And so they wore shinier watches and they ate at places that had tablecloths on it. And we were like, you know, a little messier, but they would always call us if they needed help, you know.
Yeah, so yeah. And, that's in there.
And we were like, oh, it is. Yeah. So we were a little more rough and tumble.
We would be called to assist them. They never would be called to assist us.
Manhattan South, we always call them Manhattan Soft. Cops that work in Manhattan North are tougher. So, you know, you always kind of like, there's like this whole competition. When I went to work in Manhattan South, I totally changed my opinion.
So it was a fun rivalry they had with each other. And I think, you know, in the end of the day, they all worked as a team and they worked together.
Yeah, Irma describes it before she worked there as Manhattan Soft, Manhattan South. And I'm wondering, you know, these things, they sort of strike me more as trash talk rivalries than real rivalries. And that seems to be the case, right? That's kind of like the vibe.
Yeah, that's right. And like what she said, yeah, she heard that it was Manhattan Soft, you know, the people had said that. But then she said, but when I was there, it's not. It's very difficult. You know, it's just, and it has its own challenges, you know, working in Manhattan South and what's there. So it's all tongue in cheek. They all have, you know, a fun, you know, rivalry, ribbing each other, some humor that they have to keep through. And they have to keep it, you know, that's what keeps them sane. You know, they have a very collegial affect about themselves and they all care about each other. And they spend, you know, more time with each other than they do with their families. So because of it, they kind of act a little bit like family, where they pick on each other a bit. But in the end of the day, when, you know, a crime happens, they all take it as seriously as they should and work really hard. And it means a lot to them to try to solve it.
So we do meet a really eclectic group of investigators in this series. And one that really stood out to me, and a voice that we very often don't hear from when we watch a series like this, is the medical death investigator. And we hear from Barbara Butcher here. And I'm really curious about her role. She's with the medical examiner's office. And her background, is she a cop? Is she a doctor? Like, how does she fit into the process exactly? Because we see this character on TV procedurals, right? But like, how does she actually fit into the investigative process? Did you really get a sense of that?
Yeah, well, she's amazing, right? First of all, the fact that her name is Barbara Butcher, by the way.
I know.
They would literally say that. It sounds like made up, right? The butcher comes to see.
I was a medical legal death investigator working for the Office of Chief Medical Examiner in New York. We go to that scene and investigate the body. We work with the police. The scene belongs to them. The body belongs to me.
So she's the investigator for the medical examiner who ends up having to evaluate the body, you know, for anything that could happen at the scene to the body, right? And so she's there to find out information and bring that back to the medical examiner. And she's worked with all of them. And so she's been on, you know, thousands and thousands of crimes and scenes throughout. But she's amazing. They all revere her. All the detectives revere her. Everybody, as far as just her knowledge of homicides her help and being able to help them solve the investigations. And she's just a really good person.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really powerful role because she's collecting evidence that might be, in some cases, contrary to the theory of the crime, right? Like, I think about this all the time. The medical examiner's office, they are actually working on behalf of the people, not the cops. And she definitely has an investigator's mind. And her role just seems so incredibly powerful. And to hear her talk about her theories of the crime, I don't know. I find her fascinating. And the fact that she also looks like Patricia Cornwell's main character, as she's described in her books. I mean, is that something that you thought about when you were like, okay, the Kay Scarpetta vibe that you got from her when you were interviewing her?
I did not. I mean, she speaks like a novel, you know,
yes,
when she talks, and she's so well-spoken and she's able to break down what she does in such a clear way. And she cares, as you can see too. And it comes through. I mean, the way these crimes affected her, you know, throughout, and how they're able to compartmentalize like they do and be able to do their work. But as you find, it wears on them.
I mean, we are used to that trope of that, like, hardened detective, right? I mean, Dick Wolf, for example, has given us many of those, I think, in his work. But we do hear these cops say over and over and over again in their own words how the job has affected them and that journey in their own lives. Irma Rivera really comes to mind here. She talks about growing up. She talks about becoming a cop. She talks about learning to switch off her feelings. Can you talk a little bit about that, about what we hear in her voice as she's talking about that?
It's interesting. I mean, Irma and the other detectives too, we got them at a time, right, where they're all retired now. So they had this, they were able to be maybe a bit more reflective than maybe when you're talking to the active investigators that are still in it. And so they're able to sort of look back at everything that they did and have a bit different kind of perspective than probably when you're actually in it at the time. And I go back to, again, what Detective Mooney said. He's like, every little case takes a piece out of you, you know, and you might not realize it at the time, but it wears on you and they can feel it. And eventually it's almost like they're done and they take a deep breath. But all of those cases and the pain of all the horrific things they've seen over life, it stays with them forever. And they have to figure out a way to deal with it to be able to do their job. And then people are able to do it differently. And like you said, some folks think they're just hardened or they don't have empathy. They do. And I think their empathy is what makes them so good at detectives because they do care so much about what they do. But they're able to, as Irma says, switch it on and off, like a light switch.
I can actually visualize like a switch in my head, like a light switch, and I can go click, on, off, and I can shut it on and off. It's not that I don't care, it's just that you have no control what's gonna happen, so you learn to live a day at a time, and that's how I live, a day at a time.
You know, these detectives, you know, they care so much. And to be able to, you know, turn off the horrific things that they see every day to be able to do their jobs with still the empathy that they do. I don't know how they do it. I couldn't do it.
I mean, isn't there also a situation, though, where even though as the cases are taking something away from them, they're adding to their investigative tool belt? I mean, we hear the recounting of Irma doing that interrogation, which is something that, you know, she learned was a skill she had. She brought a lot of empathy to those conversations. And so she was able to walk in after all these other cops had, you know, tried to crack this nut of this guy on video in the Carnegie Deli murders. And that's something that a skill that she developed, and experience brings you those skills, even though it's kind of taking stuff away from your psyche. You know, that's a real irony there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, with Irma, it's like you look at these detectives is one of the things I ask them always, how much of this job do you need to bring to it already? And how much can you learn? Like, can you take anybody and then just teach them? And it's a balance is what you learn from these folks. So they already have to come to it with a certain amount of soft skills, with a certain amount of demeanor, certain amount of abilities of communication, certain amount of intelligence. And then you obviously learn a lot of different skills. With her interview skills, what Irma says, and this is the way she is, she treats everybody with respect, is what she says. And she does. She doesn't care who you are. And it doesn't matter if you've committed a crime or not. She's still going to treat you with respect. And people feel that. And that's why I think she was so successful in that interrogation and in other interrogations in general. It's because she does. She speaks to people like they're a person, no matter who they are, and treats them the same way as you would. And so because of that, people were more apt to talk to her and tell her the truth because she spoke to them with respect.
I think that we tend to forget that the detectives very often are the ones who have to do the notifications to families that one of their family members has been killed, right? A lot of them talked about that and how difficult that was. Even just hearing them talk about that, I think, was probably traumatic in some ways. I mean, that is a job that I could not imagine doing even a single time. I mean, did you feel the same way when you heard these stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of them, if not all of them, would say that is one of the, if not the hardest thing to do in the job, when you have to go and tell this person's loved one that their family member has been murdered.
You got to go knock on this person's door in the middle of the night or middle of the day and tell them that someone in their family is deceased. I mean, that's really the hardest part.
Those words don't come out of your mouth easy, to say that their loved one has been murdered, you know, tragically like this and senselessly. And it's, I think there's another level to it.
And you can't help feel the responsibility of that, the weight of that, and then the pain of the other person that you're telling it. And so again, it's one of those things where they have to be able to do that as part of their job and then go off and continue to investigate. For me, that would be my day.
Yeah.
It would be tough to shake that off right afterwards. And it wears on them. And they might be able to squelch it in the moment, and they might be able to focus up. They can, they're great at compartmentalizing it. But I think as you learn and you see throughout the series, it stays with them.
I kept thinking that as I was watching this, not only would that be my day, but I would be like, okay, I did that once, never have to do it again. And that's probably how I would feel after solving a murder too. Like, okay, I've, you know, it just seems like the fact that they do this over and over and over again is just astonishing to me. You know, and we hear this isn't only a challenge for cops. You know, we hear that Richard Plansky, he ended up leaving the district attorney's office because the idea of not getting victims justice at trial was just eating him up. I mean, can you talk about that a little bit, that legal side and the challenges there?
Yeah, I mean, Rich Polanski's amazing, right? He's this guy, and we didn't get too much into his bio, but he graduated like Harvard, top of his class, law school, could have gone wherever he wanted to do, but felt, you know, a responsibility to prosecute these crimes. And he cared so much. And I think, you know, again, Rob Mooney said it, you know, he by far had the intellect to do the job, but he wasn't able to, at the time, build the emotional, he didn't have enough time to build the emotional scarring that they all had to do.
And I thought about the fact that I had just gotten engaged and had this vision in my head for being a husband and hopefully a dad someday, maybe coaching a little league team. And then I thought of the way that my life would look if I said yes. And I said no.
You know, you get scar tissue that can help protect you. Emotional scar tissue is, I think, what Rob Mooney happened. And because he cared so much, Rich Polanski, about it, and what Barbara Butcher explains, like, the DA is in everything, you know? They hear all of the case from the beginning, middle, and end. They have to know it. They have to study the crime scenes. They have to visit with the families. They have to hear everything and see every piece of it. So they really have to absorb the whole case. So to be able to do that, and so with someone like Rich Polanski then, who takes that responsibility so seriously and cares so much. And, you know, during that case, as he talked about the East Harlem serial killer case, he didn't eat. He lost like 20 pounds during it, and it wore him. But in the end, for him, just became too much emotionally for him to be able to do it because he cared too much.
So I want to touch on a couple of the cases that you profile in the series. One of them is a multiple murder that happened above the Carnegie Deli.
When we got to the scene, we had a hell of a lot of people outside, and also the restaurant was jammed. The uniform closed the place down. We want to keep the crowd there so we can interview them. Try to get witnesses as quickly as you can.
This is a tourist attraction, a famous landmark in Midtown. And to me, this case really drives home what's unique about some of the challenges of investigating a really high profile murder in New York. Tons of people around, lots of intersections of cultures and personalities. And it's a lot, a murder like this, right? Despite the fact that, as Barbara Butcher said, you know, you shoot a lot of people, you're going to get caught. There's a lot going on in a scene like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you get a sense of it. And I mean, you have Nightwatch who comes in, you know, Wally Zines, who ran Nightwatch for us. Just imagine having to control that scene, that area, right? You're in the theater district in New York, and evening is such a busy time with all these people around. So being able, and also you don't know exactly what's happening, right? So you have to make sure everyone's protected at the same time. Is a suspect still out there or are they not? And then you have to investigate the scene.
So I remember it went something like this, like, who are you? And what are you doing in my crime scene? Are you in crime? No, I'm not. Well, then who are you? I'm the police commissioner's photographer. And I'll tell you exactly what I said. You can decide to bleep it out. I was like, I don't give a fuck who you are. Get out of my fucking crime scene.
It's such a dynamic situation that has such high stakes if you do something wrong, and they do it in such a coordinated fashion. It's really miraculous how they're able to put it all together. But no, it showcases that investigating a homicide in a place like that has its own particular set of challenges and why those folks are so good at what they do.
I'm just curious because these cops tell these stories as if they happened last week. The details that they seem to remember about visiting these scenes, about the sights, the smells, I mean, the detail about tourists unhinging their mouths to wrap around a sandwich in the Carnegie Deli, like the sort of visceral nature of this storytelling, is it because these events were traumatic, or is it because that's the nature of this work, that these cops remember things so crystal clear?
That's interesting. I don't know. I would guess it's a bit of both. You know, they're so observant and so great with details, obviously. That's part of their job, of what they have to do. But like I said, they care about these cases, you know, and these were cases that we started that impacted them for whatever reasons, and different cases for different detectives. These cases had a big impact on them. So they remembered them really well. And like you said, the details were not just about the evidence that was there. It was about the smell of the air. It was about the sandwiches, right? It was about, you know, it felt like when they were telling us about the cases, it felt like they were going back there, which they were in their mind.
Well, Roger Perino has an incredible anecdote about the Carnegie Deli case that he then ties to a lesson that he says might have saved his life on 9/11. Can you just unpack that for us a little bit?
You know, 9/11 was one of those things we all wanted to be careful about how we showed it, and to make sure that it got the reverence that it deserved, and to make sure that we were talking about it the right way. So we struggled a lot. You know, we worked with the Netflix team and Lindsay and her team and us about how much we could put in, how much we couldn't, because they all had these incredibly powerful, moving stories about that day and what happened to them that day and people that they lost and how it affected them. But in the end of the day, Perino's within our world was the most connected to actually this Carnegie Deli case, because as he told the story, during the Carnegie Deli, when he was called to scene, he came from his kid's baseball game. He was wearing shorts. There was a strict dress code for the NYPD homicide detectives. They have to wear a suit. So he wore shorts because he wanted to get there quickly, and he got chastised for it because of it. So when 9/11 had happened, he was also coming from a baseball game. He had shorts on, but this time he said, I'm going to get changed.
I survived September 11th. Perhaps that 20-minute change would have put me in a different location that would have came up with different results. And I kind of always accredited that lesson with having to put the suit on and not responding in street attire to saving my life.
Because the time it took him to change his clothes, because he learned his lesson from Carnegie Deli, that time you might have been in another area down in the World Trade Center. So because he went and got changed, it likely saved his life.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't just get chastised. He got transferred for wearing those shorts.
Yes.
Like, they were not happy. I think Bernie Carrick also wasn't happy that he told the photographer to get the hell out of that scene. It was another lesson that he may have learned at that scene. He's a great storyteller, by the way. Perino is really, really compelling cop. So another case that you cover is this really gruesome 1997 killing involving 15-year-old Daphne Abdallah and Christopher Vasquez. Beyond the murder mystery, there's this lingering moral mystery of why did this crime happen? You know, this sort of other thing. The investigators throw out theories here. And I'm wondering, as you were making this story, did you all think about why? Did you develop your own theories? Did you become amateur investigators?
It's hard. I want to be careful about, you know, for us saying, it's our speculating for why they did it. We tried to take the words of the detectives, obviously, and the prosecutors and their thoughts and theories, you know, throughout of what happened. I think you had Barbara speculated, could it have been a folie à deux?
Where the two of them combined their insanity to form one killing machine? Or just kicks? Why? 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 That's the kind of thing that drives you crazy.
I think in the end, you know, the detectives and the prosecutors believed that Daphne Abdallah was the one that was more culpable if there was a case. She was the one who was the leader of that group for this crime.
So the police employed some different techniques to solve the disappearance of Eridania Rodriguez. She was a cleaning woman who disappeared in a high rise. Can you talk about why it took so long to find her in that office building?
I mean, it's massive.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so it's like you have this massive office building and she vanished. So it was very much like, how does she just disappear?
Yeah.
So if you've been to one of these sky rises and where that one takes place and where that one is in Wall Street, it's huge. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of people that work their way through it. So just even clearing it out and then being able to go floor by floor, and where they ended up finding her was stuffed in an air duct.
The smell that was on the floor is the smell of death. And the detective was like, take a look inside. And I could see some blood and residue coming from the air conditioning duct.
And one of the things that you found out in the case, one of the reasons was it was the air conditioning was flowing the day for one of their large search days. So because of it, when they brought in the dogs, the air, the scent was throwing the dogs off because of the airflow. When the air stopped, they were able to get a better hit on where she was.
Hmm.
You know, it just shows you another challenge of being a detective and a homicide detective in New York and all the different elements you have to deal with.
Hmm. Another case is that of Howard Pilmar. After years and years of suspicion and this tiny little piece of blood evidence, his wife Ross and his brother-in-law were convicted of his murder. What stands out about this case is what it did to that family. Their son Philip grew up estranged from the Pilmar family, his grandparents, and they really wanted a relationship with him, but Philip is standing by his mother in his father's murder. There's always suffering for loved ones in these cases, but this one really hits differently, right?
Yeah. I mean, Frank, gosh, when you talk to that guy, I just spoke to him the other day about what's going on, and it's on his mind all the time. And as he says, it's like he felt like he lost two people. You know, he lost his son, which was horrible, his only son, but then he also lost a relationship with his grandson, who he's very close with and adored.
That day in March, I lost three things, two of which I can never, ever get back, my son and my business. But I also lost Philip. And I know Philip doesn't want to look at me. I'm sorry about that. But I just want him to know we love you and we want you back. Please.
And so just the heartbreak of seeing that, And just another aspect of what can happen with these homicides, a case like this, of how it tears apart a family in that way, is tragic.
Now, despite what we see on Dick Wolf procedurals and despite very recent news, we do hear, and it is true, that serial killers are rarer still in New York City. But this team did unravel the case of Aaron Key. Can you talk about how luck and spelling helped solve that case?
Yeah. I mean, this case was a case that, as you saw, it was a massive case, and we could only show a bit of it, right, in our stuff. It's just the amount of people that were involved in this case and the task force that they formed to try to stop this horrible, horrible guy. And Aaron Key, you had this guy who, you know, his name was spelled a couple different ways. So there was a case years before. He had been investigated earlier under another name, and they were able to put together in a very complicated way, tracing it back and realizing that the names matched from a past case, which ended up being one of the linchpins of being able to solve the case.
One of the detectives from the 23rd Precinct saw the way that the first name was spelled, A-R-O-H-N, sort of an uncommon spelling.
He was like, well, what about this case? And he ran and he got the Paolo Ilara case.
Which just shows, you know, how you investigate everything. And it was because they had such a great team on that and be able to look at so many different aspects and went through all these different cases throughout New York City, but they were able to put together the pieces to finally catch him.
So in the final scene, you gather the many investigators we've heard from at a bar for a get together, and we get bits of what they're saying to each other. Now, as a relative outsider, of course, you have spent time with them at this point, but I'm curious, what struck you about their conversation?
I mean, first of all, it was so awesome to see them together, you know, because we had been interviewing them separately. So they've been talking about each other. You didn't get to see them in the room together. So to feel that familiarity, you know, and how much they actually did really care about each other and like each other, I guess that was really great to see. And then again, just how honest and open they were with each other about their feelings and how reflective they were able to, genuinely reflective, they were able to be about their careers and what this job meant to them and what they cared about.
That's what really makes you a professional, when you can do your job and go home and not bring it home with you.
But you do bring it home, but you might not be aware of it.
The coping mechanism, like Barbara was saying, that's how, you know, the dark humor that we had with each other. And we were able to separate, you know, the two. Like, we had an emotional attachment to the victims and their families and things like that, because we knew there was a hole or a void left. But amongst each other, we were doing stuff like this.
You know, and as you can see, you probably get a vibe from their very different personalities, all of them. But in the end of the day, they're like a family. They really are. You know, for us, it was felt like kind of like the Avengers got together and getting to see in one room. So it was really great to see. But in the end, it was just, I think as Bill McNeely said in the end, you know, what they do for a living, it matters, you know, and it's more than just a career. It's a calling. And that's what they all really felt and believed.
Do you think that viewers who might have a perspective on, you know, policing in 2024 and sort of the hard-boiled nature of New York cops will be surprised to hear this conversation that they have about essentially the importance of community policing, you know, getting to know the people that they're serving and protecting?
I hope so. I mean, you know, it's like, because there's obviously, I mean, you know, for these folks, we try to focus on the human stories of them, right? And the folks that we focused on, you know, you can see how much they care. And how much they cared about their job, how much they cared about getting it right, how much they cared about telling the truth, how much they cared about their victims, how much they cared about their families, how much they cared about getting the bad guy, how much they cared about trying to make their community safe, and then how much they cared about each other. And so these folks went to it with a mission to do the best they could every day with their job to hopefully get justice for people who have suffered the worst kind of crime you can, murder. And you, just by seeing how much they care and how much it still wears on them today, it gave me a better appreciation for them and for what they do.
Well, executive producer Adam Kasson, the series is Homicide New York and certainly gave us a brand new look at cops in New York and how they do what they do and the crimes that they solve. Thank you so much for talking to me about how you made the series. It was a really fascinating conversation.
Great. Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks again to executive producer Adam Kasson. For more of my takes, check out my other podcast, Crime Writers On. Each week on that show, we break down the latest in true crime documentaries, TV shows, podcasts, and pop culture. If you like You Can't Make This Up, please rate and review the show and share it with your friends. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. And make sure to follow the show to stay tuned for all new episodes. You Can't Make This Up is a production of Netflix. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Thanks so much for listening.